Education and Employment Committee will now come to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Latvala.
Here.
Vice Chair McLean.
Here.
Committee Whip Andrade.
Here.
Ranking Member Williams.
Here.
Representative Alupas.
Here.
Representative Arrington.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Barrero.
Here.
Representative Bush is excused. Representative Fine.
Here.
Representative Harding is excused. Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Hinshofsky.
Here.
Representative Lamarca. Representative Maney.
Here.
Representative Mariano.
Here.
Representative McCurdy.
Here.
Representative Morales.
Present.
Representative Trabalsi.
Here.
Representative Tuck.
Here.
Representative Valdez.
Present.
Thank you. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Please remember to silence all electronic devices, be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters, and remember to push the microphone button after you have been recognized. Before we get started, I wanted to take a moment to recognize a couple friends in the audience from Pinellas County, the Juvenile Welfare Board. We have the CEO, Beth Houghton, and also Becca Teeter, as well as a couple board members. So, welcome. Pinellas County just so happens to be in not only my backyard, but the backyard of the greatest quarterback to ever play, Tom Brady, who Rep Hawkins just informed me, officially announced his retirement, which will explain why I may be a little grumpy today. Good morning, members. Today we have three bills on the agenda. First up will be Rep Placencia, House Bill 235. You are recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair, members of this committee. HB 235 revises the requirements relating to the use of mechanical and physical restraint. The bill prohibits who may use mechanical restraints in the exercise of their duties to restrain students in grades 6 through 12 to school resource officers, school safety officers, school guardians, or school security guards, and that's the bill.
Thank you, Rep. Placencia. Are there questions on the bill? Are there amendments? There are none. Are there appearance cards? Caitlin Clibbard, Disability Rights of Florida. You are recognized.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for hearing this bill, and thank you, Representative Placencia, for carrying the bill. We think it's very, very important. Disability Rights Florida represents or advocates on the for the interests of people with disabilities across the state. We're very interested in making sure that children with disabilities in public schools are not treated poorly and inhumanely. Using handcuffs and straitjackets and other types of mechanical restraints on children while they're at school in a place where they're supposed to feel safe and be able to be educated is harmful to them. It's very traumatic. The kids we hear from when we get calls about this kind of thing speak of being terrified. They think they're being arrested. They think they're going to jail. They don't know when they're going to see their parents again. And some of the kids can't even verbalize how they feel, but you can see from their behavioral reactions how traumatized they have been by the use of these restraints. And I just want to say that, you know, the state has had a goal for a long time of reducing the use of restraint and seclusion, and I believe we can get that to an elimination, actually. We eliminated seclusion last year. You eliminated seclusion last year, which we greatly appreciate, and I think we can do that again here today. In the state, more than half or about half of the restraints, according to the most current data, are used on kids in third grade or lower. So these are 8 or 9, 6, 7, 5-year-olds being used with these restraints being used on them. Some of these restraints last for more than an hour. It's not just a moment. It can be very prolonged, and that's that it just increases the trauma. You know, last year's bill went a great way in eliminating seclusion, and it left in place this language about mechanical restraints. But the other thing last year's bill did was it beefed up the ability of teachers to receive training on positive behavior interventions and supports, which are the alternative to mechanical restraints. So that training is already in place for teachers. And I also want to clarify that with the statutory language as it is and with this bill, it makes very clear that assistive devices are not included in this ban. So lap belts to help a child remain properly seated in a wheelchair, for instance, would not be banned under this bill. Any device that is prescribed by a doctor or a behavioral specialist would still be allowed to be used in the manner that it was prescribed. And just briefly, you know, the data shows that there are very few schools, very few districts in Florida that still use mechanical restraint. According to the district's policies that they post online, only 9 districts allow the use of mechanical restraints in their schools. We have 67 districts in Florida. That means 59 districts have figured out how to safely educate kids, keep the teachers, keep everyone safe without using mechanical restraints. And I think we can bring that to zero. I'd really like to see that happen. And this bill will do that, and it'll do that in a way that maintains kids' ability to continue to use their important assistive devices. Thank you again for hearing the bill. And if you have any questions, I'm available to speak to those.
Thank you very much for being here. Next, we have Albert Bolito, SBLC Action Fund, who waves in support. Mary Lynn Cullen, Advocacy Institute for Children, waves in support. And Pamela Birch Fort waves in support. Members, we are in debate. Would anybody like to debate on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Placencia, you're recognized to close.
Wave close.
Thank you, Representative Placencia. Missy, please call the roll.
Representatives Alupas?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Panchowski?
Yes.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Maney?
Yes.
Mariano?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
McCurdy?
Yes.
Morales?
Yes.
Cabulsi?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Valdez?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Chair Latvala?
Yes. By your vote, House Bill 235 will be reported favorably.
Thank
Congratulations.
You.
Next, let's take up Representative Federhoff's PCS for CS HB 1203.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair, and thank you so much for hearing this bill this morning. So basically, we have a PCS for this bill, but I'll go ahead and explain what the original bill did, and then I'll go ahead and explain what the PCS did.
Alrighty.
That works for you, Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. So House Bill 1203 clarifies the longstanding position that a school district is only able to set its standards of services offered to the public by retaining the exclusive right to establish procedures for evaluating the performance of its district employees. So that is the original bill, Chair.
You want to explain the PCS?
Yes. So the proposed committee substitute maintains the underlying bill, which provides that they can do that, but it also adds reporting sexual misconduct and background screening. The PCS revises requirements for background screening reporting sexual misconduct by establishing a criminal penalty for individuals who knowingly fail to report sexual misconduct that could impact an educator's inclusion on the school employment disqualification list, allowing charter and alternative schools to file fingerprints and pay background screening fees directly to the Department of Law Enforcement rather than going through the school district, and providing the pre-service teachers who complete a background screening for a field experience assignment are not subject to rescreening by another school district so long as they undergo regular screening every 5 years. The PCS also addresses recommendations from a recent audit of Florida's Teacher Preparation Program Accountability System by requiring programs to teach strategies supporting evidence-based grading practices, streamlining the criteria for continued approval of teacher prep programs to focus on candidate readiness and placement in critical shortage areas, authorizing the State Board to weight program approval criteria, requiring the State Board to adopt rules to streamline small program evaluation, and requiring pre-service candidates at traditional preparation programs to complete 60 hours of field experience before starting an internship, which will better prepare teacher candidates for classroom and student exposure. PCS also specifies that instructional evaluation procedures are not subject to mandatory collective bargaining and thus may be changed unilaterally by a school district. Current law provides the unilateral right of a public employer in Florida to set standards of services to be offered to the public. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions on the bill? Are there amendments? Seeing no amendments, we'll now move into public testimony. Colin Kirkland, St. John's County Public School District, waves in support. Kathy Bohm, Florida Education Association. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Latvala, committee members. The goal of ongoing teacher evaluation is always focused on improved student learning, with an understanding that it's a complicated process where teachers respond on the fly to every child and every event that happens in their class, both planned and unplanned. Unlike many private sector evaluations, there's a checklist of employability skills and essential functions. But evaluations in teaching are more like the progress monitoring system we'll be hearing about tomorrow in early learning. It's not a checklist, but a critique and a coaching process. And because compensation is tied to the outcome, it must be part of the bargaining process with the state as a term and condition of employment. The legislature requires the evaluation results be used to determine compensation and placement. And because compensation is attached, the teacher who is not highly effective has the right to say, that's not fair, and has an absolute right to address those grievances. When we participate collaboratively in the design work for the district's evaluation process, we're able to build a system that's fairer to the individual teachers and more uniformly administered from school to school within a district. Together, we set performance standards, trainings for observers, so they're calibrated for consistency and clear expectations for every level of performance. Because we do expect some degree of school to school and grade to grade and subject to subject consistency. When we develop the system together, we lessen the likelihood that an individual teacher says, that's not fair. And that makes the school environment more about learning and less about conflict and controversy. We urge you to oppose this bill.
Thank you. Aaron Lagosh, Orange County Public Schools. I'm sorry. Ms. Bohm, we have a question. Representative Hanjofsky, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I just had a question about the process. So if these evaluations are part of the collective bargaining, it's been mentioned in previous committees that there's an impasse and that means everything stops. Could you just explain if there is a disagreement in that process or an impasse, as it's been called, does that mean everything stops or what is the process beyond that?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. If the two sides are in opposition and disagreement and both of them feel like they cannot make continued progress, then one or the other side will declare impasse. At that point, there are several options, but the most expedient thing would be to go directly to the school board and hold a hearing. In that case, the school board sits as an impartial legislative body, listens to the presentations, and then makes a decision. And that can go fairly quickly.
You have a follow-up?
No, Chair, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason Lagosh, Orange County Public Schools. Thank you for being here. Megan Fay, Florida Association of District School Superintendents. Thank you for being here. Shan Goff, Foundation for Florida's Future. Thank you for being here. Jacob Oliva, Senior Chancellor, Florida Department of Education. Thank you for being here. Dr. Paul Burns, Florida Department of Education, Deputy Chancellor for Educator Quality. Thank you for being here. Kathy Smith, waves in opposition. And I apologize. Adeline Joseph Theophile, Florida PTA, waves in support. Oh, thank you for being here. Members, we're in debate. Representative Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Chair Latvala, and thank you, Representative Federhoff, for bringing this bill forward. I am a little concerned of the setting of the teacher evaluation. Having been in a school board and understanding what goes on with the negotiations, usually it's, and again, I like the way that Ms. Beam actually presented as a progress monitoring type thing that how teachers get evaluated is very similar. And I'm concerned that this, how procedurally this would look like at a school district. When will that twice a year be evaluated? Teachers should be evaluated, in my opinion, on a continual basis with pop-ins and giving that coaching and that ability. We have many first-year teachers that usually by the third year, they're gone because the supports aren't there. And I'm just very concerned on that. The rest of the build is all right. I'm just really concerned about what this would look like procedurally and considering the shortage of teachers that we have. How will this policy change impact the teacher shortage? I'm just extremely concerned about this, the procedures set forth and what the expectation is. You have to be considerate when you're trying to set dates of when you're going to evaluate. You're not going to evaluate on the first day of school. You're not going to evaluate right before a holiday. And now you're taking the school district or the school board actually out of this equation as well by giving the job per se to the superintendent, and there's a missing balance there. So I am concerned only for the future of teachers and how we are going to continuously maintain high quality, high effective teaching teachers in the classroom, and by just saying that we're going to evaluate them twice a year, and in some districts you might just find that that's all they're going to do is twice a year because that's what the law says. So I'm concerned about this, but I don't know how I'm going to vote on this. I can't tell you right now. I'm not feeling it because of the teacher shortage situation and the lack of collaboration. I think that school districts need to have that collaboration with the teachers' unions and listen to their teachers. And I'm speaking of one that hasn't been supported by the teachers' unions, so I have no dog in the hunt other than I want our kids to have a high-quality, effective teacher in front of them that's constantly being monitored and coached to be the best teacher they could be. Thank you.
Representative Hinchoski, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And a lot of the good stuff is in this bill, but I go back to that section on lines 441 to 443, where it's saying it cannot be, the evaluation system cannot be part of the collective bargaining process. In the professional world that I was in outside of government and in my previous role serving as mayor of a city, the evaluation process was always working together. It was a cooperative process, getting input from our city manager as to what they felt were fair and good evaluation criteria, and what we as a board felt were good evaluation criteria. The same in the business world. So without that collaboration, I don't know how the evaluation criteria can be the best they can be. If we are going to treat teachers as partners in educating our children, I believe they have to have, not be the only voice at the table, but they need to also be a voice at the table. And by eliminating this as part of the collective bargaining, we're kind of eliminating that they will be a voice at the table. And I only bring that up because we heard that if there is an impasse, there is a quick way to resolve that, and that is the locally elected school board. So that is my only issue with this. I just don't feel that it represents the best that we can have for teacher evaluations for our children, and therefore I will be a no on this for that reason. Thank you.
Any other members wishing to debate? Well, I know that there's a lot of things in this bill. I just wanted to highlight one aspect of it. Establishing a criminal penalty for individuals who knowingly fail to report sexual misconduct that could impact an educator's inclusion on the school employment disqualification list. That was added as a result of a bill that this committee in this House and this legislature passed last year. And we have found that that has still become an issue across the state of Florida. And I thank you for adding that in your bill because it needs some teeth. With that, you recognize the close.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for those kind words. I'd just like to address a couple of things from debate and also the comments from the public. Not fair. It's not fair for our kids to not be evaluated in a updated way. And basically right now, where Ms. Bohm was coming up and speaking on behalf of the teacher evaluation, saying that it can go to the board and be resolved quickly, we have an issue here in Central Florida that basically they've been at an impasse since 2017. 2017, they've not been able to change their evaluation systems to address better ideas, better ways of evaluating our teachers to improve that process. So you can't tell me that it can be resolved quickly. I'm sorry, that's 2017, 2018. It's too long for us to basically tie the hands of a county in doing their evaluation process just because they want to tie it to collective bargaining. Previously, this has not been tied to collective bargaining. This was simply brought up due to a PERC order a few years ago, basically saying that it should be tied to collective bargaining. We have never said at the state level that this should be tied to that. And we actually changed our evaluation process back in 2011 to ensure that there is a standardization to our evaluation process across the board for our teachers. So the fact is, there's a process in place, it's working, we're trying to allow our school districts to make changes to their evaluation processes as they go along to improve them, and we're tying their hands by putting this with collective bargaining. So it's not fair to our students to do that. I'd like to say that first. We are not changing the evaluation process in this bill. We're simply saying it cannot be tied to collective bargaining when they're making those choices. It's delaying the changes. It could be impacting teacher shortage because they're not able to make those changes to evaluations to ensure that we are keeping effective teachers on board. It's just an aha moment there. So we're not eliminating anything that was there before. We're just trying to move forward and make sure that evaluations can be changed as we go along without it being tied to wages or worker conditions and so on. So thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Fetterhoff. Missy, please call the roll.
Representative Zalupas?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
No.
Bell?
Yes.
Barrera?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Hunchofsky?
No.
LaMarca?
Yes.
Maney?
Yes.
Mariano?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
McCurdy?
No.
Morales?
No.
Trabulsi?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Valdez?
No.
Williams?
No.
Chair Latvala?
Yes.
13 yeas, 6 nays.
Members, by your vote, PCS for CS, House Bill 1203 will be reported favorably. Congratulations. Last, we'll take up House Bill 447 by Rep. Trabulsi, Required Instruction in the History of African Americans. You are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Latvala and members. It's nice to see you this morning. I find it really poignant that I am presenting this bill for African American studies on the first day of Black History Month. So thank you for that. There are no coincidences in the Florida House. House Bill 447 supports teachers' efforts to include local Florida African American history through cemeteries to address standards that already exist in American history, world history, geography, and civics. It increases students' participatory citizenship by engaging students in local community history, and honors, preserves, and protects local African American cemeteries as sites of education for African American history by incorporating local cemetery history in social studies and education. And that is the bill.
Thank you, Rep. Tobolsky. Members, are there any questions on the bill? Are there amendments? Seeing no amendments, there are appearance cards. Adeline Joseph Theophile from Florida PTA waves in support. Shannon Peck Bartel, educator at Hillsborough County, you are recognized.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here. I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Shannon Peck Bartel. I'm the director of the Rose Hill Cemetery Place-Based Learning Program, which is in Pinellas and Hillsborough County, as well as an educator for the past 17 years with the Hillsborough County School District. I just wanted to take a moment to give you the opportunity to ask any questions that you may have about my experience working with students in K through 12 and the experiences that they've had working in African American cemeteries and the local descendant community.
Well, thank you very much for being here. And as the educator who contacted me about this very worthwhile project, and as the teacher who in the Tampa Bay area you have uncovered these cemeteries, and along with your students, and you have developed curriculum based on the very interesting and distinguished folks that are buried there. Can you educate the committee on the fascinating story? And I won't tell you about all of the, I won't have you educate us on all of the different people that are buried there that you've talked to me about. But can you take a few minutes to educate the committee members on a very fine gentleman that's buried in Tarpon Springs by the name of Christopher Columbus, who also goes by Richard Quarles?
Sure, I would be delighted to. Thank you. So when we first went to Rose Hill Cemetery, which is the largest segregated intact African American cemetery in Pinellas County.
Be closer to the microphone.
When we first started working with students in Pinellas County and Hillsborough County School District at the Rose Hill Cemetery, which is the largest intact African American cemetery in Pinellas County, the students immediately noticed that there was an anomaly standing out in the middle of the cemetery, and that was the marker of a Confederate veteran, which struck the students as being very unusual in their mind and odd, considering that we were in a segregated African American cemetery. And so the students began to learn the story of a man whose name was Richard Quarles, and he was born enslaved on a plantation in South Carolina. And he was forced to, as an enslaved individual, to serve his master, the Quarles family, in the Civil War. When the Civil War ended, he fled, and he changed his name to Christopher Columbus. It was the only other name that he knew. And he settled in Florida, in Tarpon Springs, where there was an active, thriving African-American community working in the fishing and the lumber industry. Students have come across and interacted with lesson plans that expose them to his ability to start an ox cart business. He became a thriving businessman to the point where when he passed in the 1920s, he received a column and a half obituary in the local newspaper. On top of that, the students are able to look at primary sources such as him filing noise complaints against neighbors, bringing this element of humanity, an element of a man who is able to overcome so many struggles and so many hardships to make himself a cornerstone of the local African-American community. When he died, his wife received a letter from the local KKK providing a portion of the payment for his funeral. Our assumption is that the KKK had no idea that he was a former enslaved man, and that the contribution was because of the fact that he technically received a Confederate pension due to being shot in the leg. In the 2000s, The Daughters of the Confederacy petitioned to place a Confederate monument. And as you can imagine, there was tension and struggle in the local community in regards to what to do with this very complicated, very difficult history, this rich facet of just so many different elements to his identity and his lived experience. And so today, what you will see in the cemetery is a Confederate monument honoring service as an enslaved man, required to, as an enslaved man, serve his master. But you also see things like conch shells placed on the tombstone and placed around him, which is a representation and a nod to his African roots. And so the students now have a very unusual, unbelievable opportunity to think about the ways in which we recognize history and we interpret history, and we try and analyze and understand the complexities of the different historic narratives. And as Chair Latvala mentioned, this is one example. Another brief example, only because you mentioned Tom Brady, so I'm taking that as an opening. In 2020, my students doing a service day, cleaning headstones, repairing vandalism, meeting with local members of the community, came across a family who was there who recently had their father pass away and was buried. And his name was Grits. And he was a cook. And he made the best grits in the entire South, according to the daughter. And apparently, Grits was the largest Tampa Bay Buccaneers fan that ever existed to mankind. And so in 2020, when he passed, right before the Bucs went to the Super Bowl, my students on their own went out to the cemetery with family, with friends, and they decorated Grits' grave for the Super Bowl. They told him the updates of the game. They met with his family members in order to share that special moment. I do not know if the students are going back out to tell about the pending retirement or if they will be keeping that a secret, but these are the ways in which students become centered in the community, and learning and knowledge moves beyond the classroom, and it becomes collaborative, and the students learn more about where they're from and what it means to be a member of a diverse community, and how communities can talk and open up that dialogue to work together to address sometimes difficult history moving forward. So I thank you for that opportunity.
And I do not mean to put you on the spot, and I should have asked you this beforehand, but since you started talking about sports, it got me thinking about the cemetery in Tampa that we talked about and the famous baseball player that was buried there. Did you happen to remember who that was?
I don't have his name off the top of my head, but
that's very important information.
It is.
As this bill moves forward, that we find out who that gentleman was.
Yes, I apologize. I did not bring his name with me today. Okay. But again, another wonderful opportunity as a local Tampanian who played baseball in the Negro League in order to be able to be buried, to be recognized, to bring in students who maybe have little history love, so to speak, but have a large sports love. And to be able to see how even something like sports can be connected into the community and connected into history and connected to the lived experiences. And that's what it's really all about. How can we bring history alive through local lived experiences?
Yes, ma'am. Members, are there any questions? All right. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you.
Ms. Peck-Bartel did not mention to you is that the interactive learning that the students were learning about was created by herself. She was the one that took the time to research all of these distinguished folks that were buried at Rose Hill. For instance, the very first African-American midwife in Pinellas County was buried there. She tells a story about that woman. Some civil rights heroes are buried there, and she tells a story about each one of them. And she takes the time to develop the curriculum for each one of those folks that then her students learn about. We have a couple. One more card. Genesis Robinson, Equal Ground. Are you here? All right. There is no more public testimony. Members, we're in debate. Representative McCurdy, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Trabolsky. I have the pleasure of co-sponsoring this bill. And just wanted to say that this bill, I believe, is building upon the work of Rep. Driscoll that she started last year by getting the commission to investigate these African-American abandoned cemeteries. And when our history, black history, is lost in abandoned cemeteries, who then is left to tell the stories of the dead? And that's my question. So that's why I was so happy to, when I saw this bill filed in November, to jump on as a co-sponsor. Wanted to let the committee members know a very famous person, Zora Neale Hurston, that we all know. Her, she was buried in an unmarked grave here in Florida until the American novelist Alice Walker, who was famous for The Color Purple, discovered her grave. So this bill is absolutely necessary. I think it's an honor. I think it's very fitting, like Rep. Trabolsky said, that we're hearing this on the first day of Black History Month. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I encourage you all to do two things. You still have time to co-sponsor this bill, and you have time to vote yes this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. I got a little afraid that you were going to start talking about softball there. Any other members in debate? Representative LaMarca.
Thank you, Chair. I had a seventh grade social studies teacher at Rickards Middle School in Oakland Park, Florida, that required us to do quarterly, I think it was at least six or seven one-page papers on significant African-American people in history. And but for Mr. Lumpkins, I don't think I'd know that Crispus Attucks was the first person killed in the Revolutionary War for our country. And thinking about your bill and what's important about where people are laid to rest, we have a historic cemetery in Pompano Beach that's in Representative Williams' district. That has been a topic of conversation as far as making sure it is maintained properly and all that. And I think the more people understand about where people are laid to rest, especially of significant history in our communities, the more they're likely to make sure that efforts like that are properly, you know, places like that are properly cared for. And support of the bill, but thanks for bringing it forward.
Any other members wishing to debate? All right, seeing none, Rep. Trabolsky, you recognize the close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for your consideration on this bill. It would be really easy to just wave close on this because I think everybody loves this bill. But the people that are buried in these cemeteries, their voices already haven't been heard. So I feel like I owe a few extra minutes of love to this bill. And I will tell you that when I initially took on this bill, I was not in love with it. I liked it. I thought it was okay. I didn't really understand it, and I didn't love it. But as I have gotten to know Ms. Peck, and as I've had conversations with other members, and I've actually taken the time to go through and research some of the forgotten cemeteries that are in our state, and the souls that were buried there that never had a voice, that didn't get the opportunity to be heard, I've fallen in love with this bill. I think it's so powerful for us to learn these stories of people that came before us, and to have teachers like Ms. Peck that come and just take their time to really recognize something that is could just continue to be forgotten. And we're missing out, and our children are missing out by not hearing these stories, learning from them. And something that we failed to mention too was that these stories aren't just taught in the classroom. She actually takes these kids out on field trips. So number one, they're getting out, they're getting real life experience, they're seeing what these cemeteries look like. They're able to dig, and so they're learning archaeological skills, and they're learning geology, and they're learning about artifacts. And these are memories, and these are stories that they're going to be able to continue to tell their children, just like you, Representative LaMarca. Somebody influenced you with a story, and we can do the same thing. I'm going to leave this here. It's not a prop, I promise, but It is a sheet of paper that tells a little bit more about the African-American cemeteries. There's a barcode on it so that you can scan your phone and see what cemeteries might be in your district. Unfortunately, there are none in mine. However, we do have the Zora Neale Hurston Museum in our neck of the woods, so I'm appreciative of that. But this is just another way that we can work together, and I appreciate your favorable vote.
Thank you, Rep. Trabolsky. Missy, please call the roll.
Representative Zalupas?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Arrington?
Yes.
Bell?
Yes.
Barrera?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Panchowski?
Yes.
Lamarca?
Yes.
Maney?
Yes.
Mariano?
Yes.
McLean?
Yes.
McCurdy?
Yes.
Morales?
Yes.
Trabolsky?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Valdez?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Chair Latvala?
Yes. Members, by your vote, House Bill 447 will be reported favorably. Congratulations. That concludes our business on the agenda. Members, are there any comments or announcements? All right, seeing none, Representative Tuck moves we rise without objection. The meeting is adjourned.